My guest today, Grant Smith, director of IRMAP, Institute for Research Middle East Policy, is familiar to Takes on the World listeners as a reigning expert on the Israeli lobby as well as Israel's espionage activities in the U.S., including the diverting of nuclear-enriched uranium for Israel's nuclear weapons program, about which American presidents and politicians, as well as the media, seem prohibited from speaking about. And he's written a number of books on the subject, which you can find on his website, IRMEP.org, and about the Israel lobby, IRMEP, IRMEP.org, / Israel lobby. That's why he was the person I decided to go to when reading about the strange case of the Justice Department's unprecedented intervention on behalf of the United Against Nuclear Iran. Welcome, Grant Smith, again to Takes on the World.
Hello, Jeff. Thanks for having me back on again. It's a really important story, and a few people have written about it, but I don't think very many have gotten to the gist of it.
Well, you certainly have, and if you go to Google, your article from July about this is number one, and the question it asks at the very top, and I will begin by asking it, is nonprofit, quote-unquote, United Against Nuclear Iran a Mossad front? Greek shipping magnate's lawsuit that could answer questions blocked by Justice Department.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting defamation case filed against United Against Nuclear Iran, which we could just say quickly is a nonprofit charity with some high power advisors such as Dennis Ross, as you mentioned in your intro, Mir Dagan, who's a former Mossad official, and a number of other people, former Senator Lieberman, et cetera, and Mark Wallace, who was U.S. ambassador to the United Nations for a brief period of time. It functions as kind of a privateer. It's out going after companies with very public campaigns, denouncing them for doing any business with Iran. Its letter of marque, so to speak, is legislation passed across many state houses in the United States, model legislation that they drafted that enforcing a secondary boycott, that states shouldn't do any business with companies that do any business with companies that do business with Iran, and of course, federal legislation boosting up sanctions against Iran. And of course, its primary reason for existence is an unproven assertion that Iran even has a nuclear weaponization program. It insists, of course, that it does. No Western government has made such an assertion, however. So this suspiciously underfunded $1.8 million organization seems to be able to get an uncanny number of internal documents from corporations and well-aimed satellite photos, which it uses then to go after companies and name and shame in the media. One of these companies didn't like being told that Ulani had internal correspondence in the form of a consulting contract stating that it was going to do business shipping Iranian oil and that it had agreed in principle to such a thing. It said such letters did not exist, and it sued Ulani in the Southern District Court of New York, stating that its name shame campaign had defamed the organization. And so there have been some really interesting developments recently, the one you mentioned, the Justice Department getting involved, and also the judge refusing to throw it out.
Well, what's interesting is the Justice Department will not provide any reasons or any specific reason or detail about why it is objecting. And evidently, this is totally without precedent for a Justice Department to intervene in what is a civil lawsuit.
Right, right. That is exactly true. So what happened in terms of the Justice Department, they filed a motion to intervene on March 10 of this year. And this was after United for Against the Nuclear Iran had lost a number of key battles before this thing goes to trial. in which the plaintiff was saying, look, we're going to depose all of your advisors. We're going to look into who really funds you. We're going to get all this information through a process called discovery because we believe, and as the judge asserted at the end of March, that they were receiving foreign funding and that they didn't really have any evidence that Victor Restis, the target of all of their campaign, had actually engaged in any illegal activity. And so, lo and behold, after they lose this series of court battles, suddenly the Holder Justice Department shows up and files a motion to intervene and basically asked the court to throw out the entire case on September 12 of this year, saying that if it were allowed to proceed, that some classified information, some state secrets could be disclosed to the public. And so this has raised a lot of superficial analysis in the press, which doesn't really look at any of the people involved too closely. It's raised a lot of superficial analysis that this intervention, you know, what could it mean for future cases? Does this mean that any nonprofit organization that claims to have classified information could call in the Justice Department to get a case quashed, blah, blah, blah. But the important thing is that the Justice Department not only wants it thrown out, it doesn't even want to name what kind of classified information is held by this organization, how this organization can even legally be holding classified information. It doesn't have any government contracts. It doesn't have any government funding as far as its IRS declarations are concerned. It's not like the RAND Corporation or something like that that actually works for the government. As I said, it's more of a privateer of very activist individuals who have decided to take foreign policy into their own hands. So it's a very interesting intervention, and, you know, it really plays into a lot of questions about what United Against Nuclear Iran really is. Where does it get its money? That's something that no nonprofit organization really has to answer to anybody to except for the IRS, and the IRS is loath to do anything about allegations that, you know, an organization is foreign funded or anything like that. So it's a really interesting case. Probably the most interesting tie that United Against Nuclear Iran has is to the Treasury Department. There's a relatively new section of the Treasury called the Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Unit, which both the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and its think tank, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, lobbied for back in 2004. Staffed it with very dedicated Israel lobbyist types, such as Stuart Levy. And this thing has been sort of the tip of the Israel lobby spear for going after Iran through economic warfare tactics. Well, the original complaint that Ouani issued against Victor Restis named that he conspired with Demetrius Cambus to ship oil to Iran. And this is at the precise time that the Treasury Department was working on putting together a complaint about Demetrius Cambus. Others have also noted that the Treasury and Ouani tweet each other through Twitter. They seem to have a very cozy relationship. And so it's not too big of a step to assume that perhaps some classified information of some sort from the Treasury Department was leaked to Ouani, which formed the basis of its name and defame campaign, and that now they're calling in the Justice Department. Again, somewhat speculation, but now that they're losing the defamation case, they're calling in the Justice Department to get it quashed so that no one will ever know what was really going on between these two rather cloudy and hard to understand entities. And I would say one is the Treasury Department's Department of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, which will not answer Freedom of Information Act requests, and United Against Nuclear Iran, which apparently has told the Jerusalem Post that, no, no, we didn't bring in the Justice Department. They just came in on their own mysteriously. So it's a very interesting case. it's got a number of very troubling possibilities for the future if it's allowed to be quashed, which, again, it hasn't yet.
What's the schedule on that in terms of the next time it comes to court?
Sure. Well, all of this is pre-trial. Victor Restis has requested a jury trial. He's got a top-flight legal team in place. The Justice Department asked that the entire thing be shut down again on September 12. The judge, however, Judge Eduardo Ramos, doesn't seem to be in any particular hurry to honor the U.S. attorney's request. He's actually written a rather tedious 39-page opinion about the core allegations that Ulani has had to respond to, and he refused to dismiss those. And his decision on that, the very last defendant filing was on October 7, but the judge just issued his 39-page filing on September 30. So he doesn't seem at that point, that was 2 weeks after the attorney general tried to get the thing shut down, he doesn't seem to be in any hurry to dismiss this. And he's actually taken most of the core allegations that hundreds of millions of dollars were lost by this shipping company under what was, in effect, a defamation campaign by Ulani. He's, United Against Nuclear Iran has tried to wiggle out of this by splitting hairs over the meaning of defamation and questioning whether tweets and Facebook postings and press releases can really be substantive defamation. But, according to the judge, they were accusing Restis of criminal activity. It affected his professional integrity. He's not going to let them just walk away from their entire documented defamation campaign and allow them to walk out of court. They think they can, but the judge is not allowing them to get out of court on that. And so if the government hadn't intervened, this thing would be on greased skids toward either a jury trial or some sort of settlement in which Restis would be paid for damages to him if they couldn't come up with any sort of real defense, which they haven't been able to so far. But as far as, the other big overhang, what he's going to say about the September 12 request by the U.S. attorney to quash the case, that hasn't been made yet.
Well, it's interesting that Victor Restis himself is Jewish and claims he supports Israel as opposed to Iran developing nuclear weapons.
Right, lost family in the Holocaust.
And also he's represented by a well-known Jewish lawyer, well-heeled Jewish lawyer named Abi Lowell, in Washington, who also represented two former members of AIPAC who were suing AIPAC for having been fired for carrying out their duties.
Yeah, he was involved in the AIPAC cases when there was, the original 1917 espionage case in 2005 and then the subsequent defamation suits. He's a very high-profile lawyer. At this point, he has been looking at filing now. He's notified the judge that he's going to file what will be the third amended complaint. And so I think it's open. He's a very, as you say, he's been involved in this type of case, not that there have been so many of them, for a while. So it's kind of an interesting question about what sort of third complaint he's going to file to try and keep this thing in court, but perhaps try and steer around the core issue, which is the fact that these classified documents that form the basis of Ulani's apparent effort against Restis steer around the fact that they probably won't be able to get those and just work off the basis that the record is very clear that there was an intense campaign out against Restis and that if the others can't prove that it was substantial in any way by substantiated by facts, that they will have to pay some sort of damages. Now, whether he manages to get the Treasury Department to pay those damages in some sort of secret settlement, who knows? I mean, I can see the taxpayers being more likely to lose out in this than any of the actual defendants, but that's just based on looking at how a lot of other similar but not identical cases have gone through the courts over years and years.
My guess is Grant Smith, and we're talking about the United Against Nuclear Iran, which seems to be have a very thin line between it and the Treasury Department's terrorism department, which is a seems to be a wholly owned subsidiary of the Israel lobby, in which those who represent it, first Stuart Levy, now David Cohen, are unabashed supporters of Israel. As a matter of fact, Stuart Levy, I recall, went to Israel to tell Netanyahu when he was going to leave office and Obama was coming into office that under Obama there'd be no, that Netanyahu, Israel had nothing to worry about in the U.S. Treasury Department. The integration, it seems, of, that's a nice word, I suppose, infiltration, integration of pro-Israel personalities and even Israeli personalities such as Meir Dagan in the UNI into the Washington Beltway continues without much attention from most of Israel's critics. I mentioned this morning before I called you about Elbit, the Israeli company with a subsidiary here, which is also helped to build the electronic part of the electronic fence, what they call the apartheid wall or fence in Israel, as well as the electronic fence on the U.S.-Mexican border, getting a contract for U.S. Homeland Security, as if there's no American companies that are able to do that. It just raises a lot of questions about how closely intertwined the two countries are when it comes to our U.S. security.
Well, it's also just really lamentable that Congress doesn't read any State Department reports, some of which we've had declassified, Blue Lantern reports on Israeli violations and transfers of proprietary technologies to other countries. They recently passed this whole U.S.-Israel Strategic Partnership Act, totally rewriting history within the legislation and ignoring what has been a serial violation of all sorts of prohibitions on the use of U.S. Military hardware. So it is strange in that sense, but it's also, this case is also kind of a metaphor for where the Justice Department is going with all sorts of cases that have been really brought to its attention by illegal activities. If we look at this as just another Israel lobbying organization that's done some questionably legal activities, you know, before the Justice Department would maybe see such activities as arms smuggling. It would see Foreign Agent Registration Act violations. It would see election law and campaign violations, espionage, and it would just simply refuse to do anything. So it didn't really prosecute Benami Kaddish. It hasn't prosecuted Arnon Milchan, although he has admittedly recently just confessed to a slew of criminal activities against the U.S. But now we're out of that phase of willful ignorance, and the Justice Department is now actually helping to shape outcomes in which everyone can go clean and none of the dirty laundry gets aired. And I would say that the case of Stuart Nozette, who is working to funnel information to Israel aerospace industries so that they could get more money out of the U.S. for Iron Dome, quashing the AIPAC espionage investigation in 2005, the Suwannee intervention. It seems as though the Justice Department is now becoming an active participant in helping organizations completely thwart rule of law in this country. And that's probably the most important single takeaway from this entire case, is that the Justice Department is becoming an accomplice as opposed to just a witness unwilling to engage and actually uphold rule of law.
Again, my guest is Grant Smith. You mentioned several cases. One of Arnon Milchan, the very popular Israeli-born film producer, who is a darling of Hollywood, who is admitted having worked for Mossad, and as you wrote, you've written about, was involved as in the arms smuggling of nuclear triggers or Krytons to Israel back in the, I believe it was the 80s or before that, and you were the one who got the file from the FBI, which showed that the person on the charge on the receiving end in Israel was none other than the current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which the FBI did not, whose name did not redact from the document. This is you've written about that, but this is kind of an interesting story. It's not a small story that the Prime Minister of Israel was involved in nuclear arms smuggling against the United States. But it's like you can't even talk about anything concerned with Israel nuclear weapons in the media. No politician at any level has talked about that.
There was more coverage of that story in 2012 in Israel, in Israel National News and a bunch of other media outlets. They thought it was interesting. It's actually kind of a badge of honor. I mean, the mayor of Jerusalem, Teddy Kollek, was a big smuggler, and so was the founder of Israel Aerospace Industry. So it is kind of, you know, hey, you know, isn't this great sort of thing. In the United States, on the other hand, no major news agency has taken up any of these files and reported them. It's kind of the story that can't be told. And I've been kicked off a number of roundtables for even bringing it up in call-ins to National Public Radio. So it's the story that can't be told because it kind of, you know, it would raise uncomfortable questions. Well, you know, in this case, this organization, which, again, the victim is accused of kind of laundering foreign funds and intelligence, it would not be the first one that had been caught doing that. You know, the Jewish Agency, the sort of pre-Israeli government, used to funnel money to the Rabinowitz Foundation with orders to pay another organization. And this was happening back in the 60s. When the Senate Foreign Relations Committee found out about it, as we've discussed before, they quickly ordered a Justice Department investigation and their own investigation into what was going on. And, of course, none of that could happen today. I just can't imagine this particular case, which is sort of on par with what was going on back in the 60s in terms of what's really going on with this newly discovered front. Can't imagine that triggering any bona fide reaction by, you know, our representatives. It's just, it's so out of the question. It would defy all beliefs that they could actually take this up and say, no, we're going to clear the air here. We're going to find out where the money's coming from, what happened to Restis, what is Ouani, is it a legitimate charity? None of that's going to happen.
Well, Senator J.W. Fulbright, who people know about the Fulbright Scholarship, but he was the first ranking member of Congress to be targeted by Israel lobby after he held hearings in March or in the spring of 1963 when he learned that the Jewish Agency was returning funds that had been donated to Israel by support of Israel in the United States, tax-exempt funds, were coming back to the American Zionist Council, the forerunner of AIPAC, to purchase pro-Israel propaganda in the United States. And unfortunately, probably the only place you could get all this information is on your website, irmep.org. /Israel.
It's even easier now. It's just israellobby.org. It's a lot easier. It's been relocated because of, you know, the name was too long. But, yeah, all of that information is there. It provides a really solid, I think, understanding for some of the problems presented with this giant multi-billion dollar industry of affinity groups. And I think the other thing that's really interesting about Ouani is it's going through a lot of the same patterns that have happened in the past. Just like the American Zionist Council, it has now split off a new organization. It's now put together another organization that will allow it to continue in what's sort of a reconstitution if the Ouani organization is shut down. It's also got a whole bunch of friends in the press working for it. The Jerusalem Post has published on this very same day that they filed papers at the court saying, no, it's definitive, Rustis is involved in shipping things to Iran, which he doesn't deny. He's been shipping some approved foreign aid, such as soybeans from Argentina to Iran. But, you know, it's interesting that some of the same things that, that other organizations that have been caught out have done, Reconstitute, mount a giant media campaign, it's all happening right now. You know, when AIPAC was under serious threat of an espionage prosecution back in 84, it spun off the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and all the people who have been most involved in that, such as Martin Indyk, were located into the new organization. The American Zionist Council itself, shut down by a foreign agent's order, became AIPAC. So you can already see that with its new shell that it's putting together, the Committee Against Extremism, that it is ready to continue operations even if this case goes bad.
I've been following this organization for a number of years since it started, mm-hmm. back in 2009, 2008. And the letters that it sends to companies would appear that it would have some legal standing to make the demands. This is a private right. company that is not requesting or asking an organization, not a company, to stop selling whatever equipment to Iran, but it's like it's literally demanding that they stop doing that. And they have someone named Mark Wallace, who is an ambassador to some country or another at some point, who is the CEO. And it's just a strange operation that this organization can be nonprofit, but then we see what happens with nonprofits in this country. It's become a joke.
Well, it is a joke in terms of regulation. The IRS, you know, you can tell them that this organization or that is, you know, funding illegal settlements, it's doing this, it's doing that, and they won't do anything about it, and they won't even confirm, you know, whether they're taking it seriously. United Against the Nuclear Iran doesn't have the right to demand a private company sign a binding document affidavit stating that it is not involved in XYZ. It's not it's not part of the government.
It has no standing.
It certainly acts like part of the government. And so that really leads to the question. It fulfills a vital function that I'm sure this wholly owned subsidiary. You know, you talk about captured agencies. The office that we're talking about, TFI, Terrorism Financial Intelligence, is not a captured agency of the Israel lobby. It was born in captivity. It was actually created by the lobby. But it did have a problem in that it couldn't necessarily take sketchy evidence and go mount public campaigns against targeted companies. But this nonprofit certainly could. And so, you know, the thing that's strange, though, is if it were a nonprofit, a bona fide nonprofit, it wouldn't have the right to go to the Justice Department and ask for protection. That's something a government agency does when it's caught out or it's involved in FOIA litigation or whatever. But it's unheard of for an organization that claims to be a nonprofit charity, a bona fide charity, to do that.
One thing that's quite clear is, as we've talked about before, the American public is really not informed about the extent of Israeli penetration of the U.S. government and its agencies, or even the amounts of aid that we give, the United States gives to Israel. I know there are so many polls that are taken in which the recipients or the responders are asked about how they feel about U.S. support for Israel. Is it too much, just right, or not enough, whatever? But they're never given the facts and figures. And back in 1989, the last time I saw it done in a major newspaper, the Washington Post and the ABC did a poll in which they expressed in the poll that when Americans find out exactly how much Israel's getting, the support for funding for Israel goes down. And right. you've just recently completed a poll at IRMEP which shows that when they know what is Israel's getting, 6 out of 10 Americans want that aid to be reduced. But maybe tell us about that.
Right. Well, this poll was generated as a direct result of the problem you just identified. When the Chicago Council on Foreign Affairs, the World Affairs Council, does a survey, it's widely respected, and it's, for the most part, fairly well done. But they come to the wrong conclusions. They stated that, you know, U.S. support for aid was the majority position, that the U.S. would support going to war on Iran. And all of these things don't sound correct. So we did a statistically significant poll with the precise number of respondents, over 2,000, asking them a more intelligent question, which was, you know, the United States gives Israel over $3 billion a year. It's 9% of the total foreign aid budget and more than any other country. Is that much too much, too much, about right, too little, or much too little? And over 60% of Americans were in the too much category. Unlike the Chicago poll, you know, there were only about 26% who said it was about right, and then a very small segment, about 9%, excuse me, about 7.3% saying it was much too little, and 6.1% saying too little. So our survey results were like the opposite of what the Chicago Council was asking. Now, theirs was fielded before the Gaza invasion, and ours was fielded after. But it was a bona fide survey conducted through Google Consumer Surveys. And we asked a couple of follow-up questions, one of which was, we wanted to find out why so many Americans would be opposed to aid. Well, it turns out that most Americans, 64%, believe that Israel has an arsenal of nuclear weapons. And so it may be that they resent being asked to pay for this so-called qualitative military edge, when most of them believe that Israel has the ultimate deterrence to any sort of attack. So we ask questions that, for the most part, the mainstream will not ask in any public opinion survey because, I suspect it's because they know what the answers are going to be. To give someone a little bit of information and context, they are likely to give an informed response as to basically saying, well, should the U.S. continue aid to Mexico and Israel, which is, you know, what the Chicago Council asked, as though the two were the same. And, of course, they're not.
Another interesting thing is that in those polls, they always ask Americans, who do they side with most, Israelis or Palestinians? And given the one-sided propaganda in a mainstream media in which there is not a single columnist that takes a position of critical of Israel or support of the Palestinians, it's not surprising that the result looks like a football score between New England Patriots and some lesser National Football League team. But one thing they don't ask is how Israel stacks up with other countries that are allies of the United States. And in that poll in 1989, the Washington Post did that, and as far as I know, no poll has been published since, in which they asked Israel to be rated alongside England, Germany, Egypt, at that time the Soviet Union, China, and so on. And Israel was about sixth down on the poll. England topped the poll. Egypt was more popular with Americans in 1989 than was Israel. And Israel only topped, I believe, Iran and Korea, North Korea. So they don't hold polls like this anymore. At least they don't publish them. And so they ask the questions in order to get the right answers. My take on polls is that they're like a test of the public to see if they've absorbed the propaganda properly and at the same time to re-propagandize the public by the nature of the questions, by the content of the questions they ask.
Yeah, there is a world of literature on push polling as a propaganda technique. But it is interesting. Again, I stated I like the Chicago Council survey, and I think you have also alerted me to some of the things in there. One of the things that they did come out with in a very straight question was, you know, do you take sides with Israel or Palestine in the conflict? And you know, 36% was choosing one of those two options, while 64% of Americans said, you know what, neither. You know, I'm not taking sides in that conflict. Maybe it's complexity or affinity or disinterest, who knows. But, you know, when you ask either a straightforward question or you ask a question and then ask follow-up questions to see whether somebody has been misinformed, I think that's very important. And for the most part, most of these very expensive polling exercises have been abused rather than, you know, actually shaped. One of the things that we asked, because the Chicago Council found that most Americans are frighteningly afraid of Iran, well, we asked them, do you think Iran has nuclear weapons? And almost 59% think currently that Iran has nuclear weapons right now. And so if you're walking around with that kind of disinformation in your mind, of course you're going to fear things maybe that you shouldn't fear and not look at things that you should. So it's, I think polling is important, but it's not very well done when it comes to these issues.
And this is why they keep polling on trying to get American support for an attack, either Israeli or U.S. attack on Iran, by feeding this one-sided information to the public, and then they test them to see if it went down. Grant, your website is irmep.org, and information also on israellobby.org. You could find, Grant has written about half a dozen books. All of them are unique in providing information that you will not get anywhere else. Unfortunately, I guarantee that on the spectrum, and why you hear him on KZOX and you don't hear him on other radio programs, because he has information that people need to know and some other people don't want people to know. Grant, I want to thank you very much for being our guest again today on Takes on the World, and keep up your great work.
Oh, thank you so much, Jeff. And Takes on the World is extremely important, and it's an honor to be on.
My pleasure having you. Take care.